Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
Shabbat Shalom. This month, as our synagogue has embraced Pride Month, and the Supreme Court has made a historic and heroic decision barring discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, my thoughts turned to a more modest episode in the long and tortured and ongoing fight to end legal discrimination against LGBTQ plus people. The year was 2012, and the issue of the hour was same-sex marriage for all Americans, a right which, you may recall, at the time, President Obama had stopped short of endorsing. On the morning of Sunday, May 6, Vice President Biden broached the issue on national television, telling NBC's Meet the Press that he was, quote, absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying are entitled to exact same rights, all the civil rights, all the civil liberties. Journalists pounced on the perceived daylight between Biden and Biden's bosses' evolving views on gay marriage, to the point that in the days ahead, Obama would reflect publicly that the vice president had, quote, probably gotten a little bit over his skis. In the coming days, the White House reported that Biden had privately apologized to Obama for his public verbal foot fault. The most interesting thing about the entire episode was neither Biden's misstep nor, for that matter, the over-the-skis turn of the phrase henceforth part of the American lexicon, but the fact that despite what had been reported, Biden never actually apologized for the verbal misfire. Soon thereafter, President Obama would become a full-throated supporter of gay marriage, stating, quote, our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. It's worth pausing to appreciate the political theater of it all. Biden's public statement provided Obama with a trial balloon for a major policy shift. Obama's mild rebuke provided him with plausible deniability and political cover from the naysayers. While Biden's publicly misreported private apology may have denied Obama the short-term advantage of a principled stance in favor of gay marriage, in the long term, it arguably accomplished the task of bending the moral arc towards justice with the Supreme Court's ultimate 2015 decision on gay marriage. Change happened, and everyone, more or less, came out a winner. Was the entire series of events by design some sort of staged kabuki dance? Only two people will ever know for sure. But what we do know is that the vignette serves as a modest and positive case study in how the political game is played and how social transformation actually happens, how public announcements and social pressure can be effectively leveraged to prompt individuals in power to effectuate much-needed and overdue change. If the Biden-Obama story stands as a constructive example of the effective use of the public sphere, then this morning's Torah reading serves to illuminate the pitfalls when it's done poorly. At the command of God, Moses sends out 12 spies to scout out the land, to assess its inhabitants, its fruits, and its fortifications. The spies do as they're told, and after 40 days return to Moses and the entire Israelite community. The land is beautiful, they say, but we cannot attack them. They are stronger than us. We look like grasshoppers in their eyes and in our own. Joshua and Caleb try to counter the report of the 10 spies, but it's to no avail. The will of the people has been broken. For 40 years, the Israelites would be punished to wander the desert, 1 year for each day of the scouts' mission, a generation unworthy to enter the promised land. Every year we read the story of the spies, and every year the reader is left with a gnawing question of why. Why were the spies punished? They were told to scout out the land, come back, and deliver a report so Moses could proceed accordingly. They did what they were told, they agreed on what they saw, they came back, and they shared it. What precisely was their sin? Some interpreters suggest that their misstep was that they lacked faith in Moses, in God, and in themselves. Their loss of nerve, their longing for Egypt, prompted them to create fake facts and mislead the people. Others have suggested that their sin was one of mishearing Moses' charge. Moses was not interested in the question of whether the land should be conquered. Moses simply needed counsel on how to do it. The spies were stuck on the question of whether, and Moses was asking how. A subtle but critical distinction in this story and so many others. Compelling as these reasons, amongst others, may be, in my mind, the fundamental misstep of the story boils down to the question of the public and private sphere. The text is very specific. The spies shared their findings before the entire people of Israel, having publicly forced Moses' hands with news he neither anticipated nor desired. He did what any human being would do under such circumstances, flat-foot and embarrassed publicly. He dug in his heels and he swung back. The spies could have pulled Moses aside. They could have let him know on the QT that bad news was on its way. And Moses, I imagine, had he been extended that courtesy, could have caught his breath, regrouped, and recalibrated. But that's not what happened. Were we to stage the tale today, I would direct the spies to post their reports on their Facebook pages and then spotlight Moses' reaction as he checked his account to discover that the feedback he had asked for was being reported not just to him privately, but to the entire world. The spies failed on a number of levels, and for that matter, Moses' hands are not entirely clean. He could have handled himself differently. But it's this failure to appreciate the difference between feedback given privately and publicly that stands out in my mind as a damning failure of the spies and the entire wilderness generation. It's a misstep that comes into focus in our Haftorah, when 40 years later, the spies sent out by Joshua report back to Joshua and Joshua only. It is a sin that ties together this entire section of the Torah. Last week, when Miriam and Aaron speak out against Moses, it's a sin both in what they said, but also how they said it, publicly. So too next week, the challenge of Korach and his company, a rebellion which in rabbinic literature is a paradigm for an unholy controversy. Or the following week, when Moses is barred from entering the land for striking the rock, a punishment seemingly incommensurate with Moses' lap of judgment, until you realize that God's wrath was kindled not so much for the act of hitting the rock, but the fact that Moses did so publicly before all of Israel. Even, and perhaps especially, God knows the difference between the public and the private sphere. Each one of these stories, and there's so many others that I haven't mentioned, would have turned out differently had the involved parties simply paused two beats to consider not just what they were going to say or do, but how and in whose company they were going to make their opinions and their actions known. Ours is a charged season, with no shortage of pressing social and political issues. Some days, actually most days, I feel like the man in the old story who complains to his rabbi that his house is too crowded and the rabbi tells him to bring in a chicken and then a horse and then a goat into his home. We have a pandemic. We have economic uncertainty. We have racial strife. We have an imminent annexation of the West Bank. We have a crisis this morning in the Attorney General's office. We have anti-Semitism on the left and the right. Rabbi, my house is full. And we're all wondering what we can do, how we can affect change, how we can move the needle a little bit, do our part, make this broken world a little less broken. And in our desire to right the wrongs and heal the world, we want to call out injustice, foot faults and sins, small and large. We dare not stay silent. Those of us who know our history know that neither individuals nor societies change from a place of comfort. Ask not speeches of inspiration are nice, but generally speaking, fireside chats or stirring appeals to our better angels don't prompt perpetrators of wrongdoing to mend their wicked ways. Think of any movement of social change, from Moses to MLK to Harvey Milk and everyone in between. At some point, public pressure had to be exerted. At some point, someone was made to do something that the simple force of inertia would have resulted otherwise. What were the 10 plagues, if not a public demonstration of God's might to bend the will of Pharaoh before the Egyptian public? And we, of all people, as Jews, know the price of public silence. How much human savagery, the Shoah included, could have been limited if only the press, public officials, and general public had been more forceful in their denouncements. Thank God, the framers of the Bill of Rights, with the Boston Massacre still fresh in their mind, chose to protect the right of people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. As Americans, as Jews, as lovers of Israel, there is a time, and that time is now, that not only we can speak up, but we must speak up. Sometimes people need to be forced to do the right thing. And we need to use our heads. Because much as I fear for the health of our society, much as I believe in the power of free speech and of the press, of public speech as an instrument for change, I also fear for the well-being of so many whose humanity is forever diminished by the call-out culture of our age. When we see something, we should say something. But lately it seems that rather than doing what we should do, what basic human decency calls on us to do, to pick up a phone, seek understanding, dialogue, and change, ours has become a society satisfied with publicly shaming and sometimes defaming individuals before the facts are in, before context is known, before we've extended that person the same courtesy we would ask of ourselves when our actions come under fire. To defame another person by way of social media is not dialogic, and it doesn't make you an instrument of social change. It's a way to seek cheap high fives from your own teammates. It prompts the other party to dig in his or her heels because, like Moses, we all respond differently to unpleasant news when it's delivered publicly. It also undercuts the possibility of retrieving and mending that relationship when the offending incident has passed. It's a moral failing akin to that of the spies. It's easy. It's really easy to just hit reply all, to forward someone's private email, to post something on Twitter, to call someone out, to cancel someone's communal standing, to crush a person's future by way of your self-declared moral certitude and the echo chamber of your Facebook feed. You know what takes courage? You know what takes character? To pick up a phone, to seek to understand and seek then to be understood. Those 10 plagues that God inflicted on Egypt, they only happened after Pharaoh stonewalled Moses' repeated entreaties to let his people go. Tradition teaches that a person's good name, their Shem Tov, is our most valuable asset. And at risk of stating the obvious, in a social media age, we are all shareholders in maintaining the value of each other's reputations. You know, no more than 48 hours ago, I picked up the phone to a congregant, a kind and wise and long-standing member of the community. And after a bit of catch-up, he paused. He began to open up, and he shared with me that he was glad we were talking because I had some time ago caused him hurt. It was an honest conversation, and together we unpacked the incident. He understood that I meant no ill will, and upon my apology, he forgave freely and lovingly. When I put down the phone, aside from being totally mortified at the thought that I had caused him hurt, I was grateful because I realized what I had done. I understood how, in that moment, I could have been better. And while I can't undo the past, I am resolved to move forward intentionally, hopefully never to be so clumsy in my words or deeds. You know why it went so well? The secret sauce that made the conversation possible and hopefully me a better person? Because the conversation happened privately, in confidence, with willingness to share hard truths, and most importantly, a willingness to listen on both sides. When Shabbat concludes this evening, as I do every week, I'll recite Havdalah with my family. And upon singing the third bracha, we'll raise our hands to the light of the candle. We do so for many reasons, but one explanation taught to me as a young child is that to shame another person in public is akin to the crime of murder, of shfichut damim, the spilling of blood. To damage a person's reputation, akin to taking their very life. Why do we lift up our hands to the candle? In order to examine our fingers, to check if there is blood on our hands by way of the sin of careless speech. Always, but especially in this hour when we are all physically isolated from one another, let's make sure our hands are clean. Let's presume positive intent and do each other the courtesy of picking up a phone. Shabbat is a time to imagine the world not as it is, but as it should be. And this Shabbat, perhaps more than most, we're all wondering what we can do and say and protest to close that gap by getting involved and speaking out in New York, across our country, and in Israel. Sometimes we need to shout loudly. Sometimes we need to hold our tongue. And sometimes we need to think tactically to get out over our skis with the aim of prompting other people to arrive where they need to get to with their reputations intact. The gift of speech can change the world, but it can also destroy it. Maybe this Shabbat we should just remember that it's within our power to determine how we use that gift, to choose our words carefully, where they are spoken, where they are posted, and together, please God, soon, we'll arrive together in the promised land. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.